There's already, we do work with the high school, International High Schools Association, Language Schools Association, colleges and universities. We are not working with as the association, but we work at all levels of education to basically to support their initiatives. They use our platform as well for various reasons. They're educators, so they're natural mentors, I would say. So I've been lucky to have a lot of mentors in this space that has helped us. Those have helped us build the platform, give us the right piece of advice. So there's been a lot of good stuff.
Hey everybody, welcome to the GMI Rocket Show. Today is episode number 78. I'm really excited for today's conversation. I'm your host, Roman Zelichenko. I'm a former immigration attorney turned entrepreneur. I'm the co-founder of Laborless, which is an immigration tech startup that automates H-1B visa compliance, and also the founder of GMI Rocket, which is a digital marketing agency for the mobility and immigration industry, and of course also brings you the show. Today, we are going to Canada, sort of. Our guest is actually going to be tuning in from overseas. Well, I guess Canada is another country from the U.S., but you know, we're neighbors. We're basically cousins. But today's founder is Ganesh Nilanjanath, who is the founder of iSent. So iSent is an app effectively built for universities in Canada and, you know, perhaps around the world, which we'll get into with Ganesh, to help them manage their international student population. This is, it's really fantastic, especially from an immigration standpoint, because particularly for skilled workers, a lot of skilled foreign workers are actually, if you will, funneled through the education system. I mean, international students are a huge presence in the U.S. and Canada and truly around the world. And so being able to manage this population of students in the right way is really important. And to have tech to support that is important. So I'm excited to launch into Ganesh's story and how he ended up getting there through the long career working in technology. And there's going to be a shout out to one of our prior guests here today because Ganesh and him worked together, and we'll get to that. But for now, without further ado, Ganesh, thank you so much for being here. And I'm very much looking forward to our conversation.
Likewise, Roman. Thank you for your time and thank you for the opportunity here.
Absolutely. So Ganesh, I want to almost jump ahead into your story because there's so much about it that I'm really excited and interested about. But I think it's always really great and important to, you know, start by really learning about the guest and the person behind the company. And I think, you know, I love to learn about sort of the childhood in a way of each guest, in part because there are some people who start companies who've been sort of an entrepreneur their whole life. You know, they sold toys when they were, to their friends when they were kids. They had a lemonade stand, whatever it might be. And there's other people who were never like that and stumbled upon an idea, and then it sort of became a passion of theirs. So I'm curious, you know, when you were growing up, you know, tell me a little bit about that, you know, what you were maybe like as a kid, what it was like for you, and where you grew up, of course.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you. So I grew up in India. Around Bangalore region, Karnataka, India. And I've lived in school residence all my life. Mm-hmm. So right since fourth grade. So I have been very disciplined since beginning in terms of waking up on time, doing my homework and whatever else. And project management is something that I've been introduced to right from the beginning or at an early stage. Because my dad used to always, when my parents would come and meet us, what do you need, keep the list ready, so those kind of activities. So project management has been induced into my day-to-day life right since beginning. So that's part of the reason why I did project management. I'll come back to that a bit later. But yeah, I grew up in India, did my schooling, college, and university in India, did engineering in computer science from BUB Engineering College of Technology in Hubli. And then I worked in India for about 3 years, 5 years, 3 years with Zoom, minus Zoom. And then 2 years, one year in Pune, and then 1 year in Mumbai. Then I got an opportunity to work with IAC School of Business in Spain. So I did that. And I came to Canada as an international student. And then studied for a year, worked for a little bit, and then started iSent.
So, you know, and that's such a great overview. And of course, that gives me the opportunity. it gives me the opportunity to dive into so much of your story. You know, I think my question to you before you entered university, if we go back a little bit, before you entered university in India, you know, were you interested in computer science? I mean, or was this something that your parents said, look, this is a great career. You know, obviously computer science is really important in India because there's a huge technology. There was a huge technology boom before 2000. Since 2000, it has grown tremendously. And it's a really, really great way to have a good life. I mean, in the, you know, my parents, my family came here from the former Soviet Union. I was born there, but I was very small when I moved here. But, you know, throughout the Cold War, engineering in, you know, in the Soviet Union was really important. You know, math, if you were bad at math, you were made fun of, you know, whereas here in America, it's like, oh, if you're good at math, you're a nerd and people make fun of you. Back there, it was like, how do you not know this, you know? And so I wonder, did you want to do it yourself? Was it something that was pushed on you? Maybe it was a combination of both. Like, how did you lead to computer science?
Yeah, engineering was always the goal. There was no alternative option.
Wow, okay.
So engineering was always the goal. And I was always interested into automobile engineering. And I did my schooling around 1999. So that's around the time that I had to start thinking about college and the kind of engineering program that I would do. And around that time, 90s is when the application software started picking up. There's a lot of software applications came along. A computer became the thing of home. So I got to access computers around my eighth grade. So I started picking up things around that time. So turned out that I liked the computers and the computer science engineering program. So I got enrolled. And I have two older sisters. My brother-in-laws were also computer science engineers working in the US. So I was guided by them. And you know, turned out that I moved from automobile into, you know, computer science.
Were you like, so I also had a computer when I was younger, and for some reason, my parents put it in my bedroom, which is, when I think about it, crazy, right? Because I feel like the whole family would want to use the computer. But I, you know, I was tinkering. I was learning HTML. I was building websites. I was probably like 12, 13 years old or something like that. Were you also like, just when you had access to the computer, were you just intrigued by it and trying to learn about it on your own? Or was it sort of just interesting, but you only learned really how to do certain things on it when you went to school?
Sure. I mean, there's two aspects to computer science, right? One is the hardware and the physical aspects of the system. And then there is the software and what we are doing right now, the application. So when I saw the computer first, I was like, how is this made? I wanted to open it up and and figure out. So that comes there comes the automobile piece, like, you know, mantling and dismantling kind of a thing. So I was very intrigued with how the system worked, how the internet thing worked on the computers. When I started, Yahoo was the most used site, I think, around that time. I had a Yahoo email created and Yahoo News and whatever else. So I was certainly very fascinated and interested in computer science, and I could see what's happening. There was Yahoo News and things like that. So I was like certainly very interested, but I was more interested in trying to figure out how was the system mantled, how things were put together, and how it connected to the internet. We had to have a phone line and plug in the phone line to, you know, however it worked. Now we have direct broadband cables and things like that, but yeah, it was different. So it certainly was very interesting, and on top of that, you know, watching movies on the system and things like that. So there was a lot of entertainment, education, and fun.
Yeah, to think about how long it took to download things back then, and for images to render. Do you remember an image would render just line by line like this if you were loading it on a page? I mean, kids nowadays don't remember that that kind of
thing. Flash, yeah.
That's great. So okay, so then you entered university. So you went into computer science, and you obviously were interested in the software aspect of it, but you also had some interest in the hardware, which is natural because you want to know how is the thing built, and then of course how do the systems work on it. And what I mean, it's exciting to me is, so you graduated and you got your first job at INSUM. Which, you know, Umesh Wadyamat, who is the founder of INSUM, was a guest on our show. He's a big, you know, influencer and just, you know, kind of mentor and a big deal in the immigration technology space. How did you find that job? Because for me, immigration tech, and I think for most people, it's such a narrow field. Did you know about it, or was it the kind of a thing where they were hiring and you found the job and you just happened to stumble upon, you know, this company, iNetZoom?
Yeah. Around 2005, they were growing rapidly. And, you know, I was looking for a job after my graduation. I had done a campus interview and I was supposed to go to another company. But I was, while I had those 3 months gap in between before I joined wherever I had to join, I came across iNetZoom. They were hiring. So I gave my interview and then things picked up from there. And I thought, you know, let's see if I can get started here. And I always wanted to get into programming because growing up, my dream was to build a company. So, and I got an opportunity to, like how we talked about computers, I wanted to first understand the hardware piece and then come to the software. So likewise, when it came to building a company, I wanted to make sure that I understand the technicalities of building a company or a software. And then, so I started my job as a programmer there. And then for the 3 years of the 3 years that I worked there, I got various opportunities, thanks to Umesh. I mean, he used to visit India, I think, once or twice in a year. And he used to talk to the employees, and I was very fascinated in terms of how he talked, how he delivered, what his message was, and I right at that point of time I knew he could be a great mentor, and I kept in touch with him.
How is it? You know, I'm curious, and just to get a little insider information, but you know, in a good way, what did you feel about the immigration technology space or the immigration industry in general at that time? Because like 2005, there were not a lot of tech solutions out there. There were a few, you know, Zoom was one of the, was probably the first, I think, cloud-based. I'm not sure if Tracker at that time was already on the cloud or not. And I think there were a few predecessors that were really on-prem, and they were completely different. You have to get the CDs sent with the updated forms. It's still technology, but a different version of it. Did you feel that you were in this like obscure, weird niche, or did you feel that, okay, this is an industry that's, you know, random, yes, but it's growing and there's a lot of opportunity? I'm just curious how it was there at that time.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, immigration and global mobility are like, you know, it's always interesting because it's not a static, it's not a static world. It's constantly, it keeps us on our toes constantly. The immigration rules are changing. It's so interesting that you know, you feel like you're part of something bigger when it comes to immigration versus being local and focusing on something that we are doing internally within the community, within the city, within the country. Like, I wanted to think global and wanted to build a global business. So immigration was certainly the right stream. I just happened to be there. It wasn't planned, but I think it was really good. I was lucky enough to get that opportunity. And I had, as I mentioned earlier, two of my sisters, my brother-in-laws were already working in the US. So I knew a little bit about traveling and immigration and visa and some process seen behind. Just the case that the opportunity working at Zoom, it came up, and I happened to learn a little more about global immigration.
Right. Yeah, that's true. You end up, even on the software side, you mean, you have to learn about the rules and the visas and things like that. So you just pick that's up right. knowledge about the process.
Right.
I wanted to go back because Purvi asked another question here. I think Purvi said high school because Purvi went to boarding school too. So I guess she was curious.
So I did in St. Xavier's, Belgium. Yeah.
Okay.
That is also in Karnataka, India. Yeah.
Got it. Wow, that's cool. Well, maybe you were both, I don't know if that's where you went, Purvi, but maybe you were both classmates. So that's hope so. But that's cool. So you got into this position, you know, at iNetZoom, and obviously introduction to immigration law and an understanding of sort of what it means to be within and to grow a business that's kind of international in a sense. Your clients may be international. You're obviously the teams, there's an US team and an India team. And then you left. I know you left iNetZoom and you took a few more tech positions. And you know, we don't have to get into each of them into detail before you eventually moved to Canada to pursue your master's. But I'm curious, what was it like? Because I think some of those positions were not in India, right? You traveled, you lived in other parts of the world. And so at that point, now you were becoming a consumer of immigration. You needed a work visa. You needed to. So, that's like, right. What was that like to, number one, take a role in another country? And do you remember anything, you know, as a second part of that question, do you remember anything about the immigration process for you as an employee?
For sure. I mean, I had an almost expiring passport when my visa was first applied. And the trip was planned. The client was ready. Like myself and my manager, project manager, were supposed to travel. And it was Spain being applied from Mumbai. So I think my passport was about expiring. So they had to ask me to reapply and get things done, move dates and replan my trip. So so the first attempt itself was was a learning curve.
Yeah. And what was the company that you were working for?
Systems Plus. Systems so it's Plus. A Mumbai-based company, yeah.
And where were they sending you at that time?
If you're to Spain, Barcelona, Spain. To work with IAC School of Business, which is one of the oldest business schools in Europe.
And so you did move there. I mean, you eventually did go to Barcelona.
Yeah, I mean, I went there for project work, and we did the project for about a year, and I came back, and I was studying at the same time, preparing for my education abroad, and that's part of the reason why I moved out of Zoom. I wanted to study. I started doing my GMAT, IELTS, and that was 2008 mid, and turned out that the U.S. recession was it was a difficult time, so I decided to. Like again, joined the workforce, and wherever I was studying, I found a job locally there as a temporary means to spend a year, and then turned out that they had a Spain opportunity, so I continued working there for a year. I finished that, and then applied to Canada, and then started my journey to Canada.
Can you share a little bit about the work that you did while you were in Spain? Because obviously, right now, you know, you're working for or you're building a company that's supporting universities and schools.
That's right.
And this sounds like it was the first job that you had where you were working for an educational institution. So I'm curious, you know, from whatever you can share, you know, from that time, were you working on anything related to international students, or were you just helping the school with software in general?
No, I feel like, you know, it was all meant to be, because working in the immigration space, learning global mobility programs, and working in IAC School of Business, looking at those flags, all these memories are still very fresh. Doesn't feel like it was a long time ago, for a reason that after my schooling, after my initial experience, all the time that I've spent is in front of the system, building software, building a company. So whatever is all my memories are pretty fresh in that regards. So Spain, I remember entering into the business school, like bunch of flags from all countries. And that was like an awesome experience just to see the flags outside the campus. And turned out that they wanted a finance system to be built. And it was all students and primarily international, because they had their fee structure was different, their immigration process and whatever else, the kind of fee that they had to pay for application beforehand was different. So and they gave a pretty good tour of the campus, talked about how it works, how they were the oldest business school in Europe. And all of that was kind of, it was as if it was like I was not there to build a software, but to build, to strengthen my dreams of studying abroad.
Interesting. And so you were building financial software for students to be able to, I guess, pay or something. And I guess your point is that depending on where the student was coming from, they may have had different fees, different structure, different way of payment. So in a way, you were almost like being introduced to some of the challenges with international student offices, because the process isn't streamlined because it may depend on where the student is coming from. Which I guess is probably why it's hard to build software around that kind of thing, if there are a lot of different streams of processes that, you know, aren't easy to unify.
And currency, like, you know, different people paying in, they had all to be converted to a common currency. Like there was so much of learning curve there, and it felt like, you know, the world is bigger than what I think it is. And there's so much to learn. Yeah, it was all fun experience.
Okay, so now you've had this experience at INSZoom, you've learned about immigration, global mobility, and technology, and then you worked for IAC School of Business in Spain, and, you know, learned about international, like the implications of international students coming in. I mean, if you ask me, this is the perfect foundation to build where you are now. But of course, before that, you ended up going to Canada to study and to get your master's in project management, which was, I guess, fortuitous, because if you had gone to the US, where maybe you originally perhaps wanted to go or thought Sure. about, you know, who knows how it would have worked out. But you did end up going to Canada. And I'm curious, what was it like for you? Now it's your second time kind of immigrating, if you will, this time to actually study. What was it? What was that process? What do you remember about the process of moving to Canada from an immigration standpoint?
Leaving a job, a good paying job, working in Spain, leaving all those opportunities and starting school again with a lot of uncertainty around how things would work was certainly very challenging. On top of that, the immigration process in terms of applying for visa, not sure how long the visa is going to take, approximate timeline I knew, but there was always a good chance of rejection for whatever reason. And there was a lot of uncertainty, I would say, when it came to planning study abroad, and especially with the way I had to repack all of what I had done and, like, you know, close my chapter, you know, that chapter of my life and start a new life. Again, being a student was a difficult aspect, but immigration was the bridge that basically helped me move from one country to another. And there was a lot of uncertainty around it. That's what I remember. When I put down my papers at the company, I had told them that I'm studying abroad, and I had accepted the letter of offer from school at the office and scanned it in the office and told my manager, this is where I'm going.
Wow, nice.
And they were pretty supportive, and they said, they were pretty good. And it turned out that I told them, if my visa doesn't go through, I'll come back. So if it happens, great, I'll go. And then, so they said they wanted to go the business globally as well. They had a few clients in Canada. So they said, if I needed a job in Canada, they would be more than happy to offer me there. And so that was more, that was kind of, that helped me.
Comforting.
Yeah, comforting to basically understand that, okay, if something doesn't work well, I have people to rely on, and things can still work out. And there's certainly a lot of uncertainty in terms of immigration and the settlement, the initial acclimatization in the new country. Mm. I thought I was prepared, but with my Spain experience, because I thought, one time my passport expiry has happened, and, I now know how things work, but it wasn't certainly the case. Student visa works slightly differently. They gave something called letter of study permit letter. I didn't know what was, I had applied for visa, but in return, I got a visa and a letter that I had to come show at the port of entry, and they then gave a study permit. So all that process, I got educated through an agency that helped me understand how the immigration process works. Yeah. And of course, back in the days, Google was not this intelligent in terms of so much of content being available in terms of mobility programs and things like that. Secondly, there's a lot of YouTube videos right now in terms of students making videos and talking about trying to help fellow students and students that are yet planning and preparing their journey. And there's a lot of videos for sure. There's a lot of content available on the internet right now. That wasn't the case with me in 2010. So I had to rely on part of my experience, part of what the agency told me, and they were busy for themselves too. And then my parents and sisters and everybody else that had a good piece of advice, overloaded and overwhelming with a lot of information, I traveled. So,
wow. And but it's great that you had that experience, right? Because now you're working, trying to support international student offices at universities. And so what it was like to be an international student. And even if things have changed since then, new policies, new programs, just the idea of what a client, a user might need at that time, the user, let's say, being the student, in terms of documentation, information, support, just the peace of mind, to know that you're taken care of. Sometimes that could be alerts. Sometimes that could be proactive information. Those little things are really, from a user experience standpoint, they can make someone really like or dislike a software, even if the technical aspect of the software is the same. But, the thoughtfulness that goes into software, I think, for the user, in my experience, has been really important. So it's cool that you learned by actually going through it. And so now it's, I would argue, probably easier for you to understand what your clients, their universities need, because, oh yeah, right, that makes sense. I've been there.
Yeah, there was certainly a lot in the last 8-9 years that we have launched iCent. I thought I was prepared. I had some challenges. That's part of the reason why I started the program, like the software and iCent as a company. But turned out that my experience was only so much. There was so much more that we learned, scaled the built various modules in the program in the software. And we are still learning. There's still a lot. I think immigration is one aspect when you're trying to move from one country to another. There's a lot of anxiety around what no friends in the new country. Sometimes very few people that are relatives of relatives or friends of friends. And then two is career prospects. Three is currency exchange and how much money we are going to have to spend. Four is while you're studying, what kind of job will you get to do? Will you be able to manage studies and work together? So there's a lot of questions that come up. So when we provide software services to international students today through the authorities, that's the international offices at colleges and universities, they know how to provide 360-degree support to their students. Mm-hmm. So we rely on them to basically help us understand what are their needs. So although we call it iCent app, for international students, the sole motto is to basically empower the international offices to better support international students. They have been doing it for ages. They know how to better support their students. Just the case that, you know, if I classify it into three generations, there's paper generation, website generation, and now there's the smartphone apps, smartphone app generation. So I was in between paper and websites 10 years ago because I got some papers and then there's still websites, but the websites were not as fast. And, you know, nowadays you can, you know, launch a website in a matter of minutes and hours using templates. Back in the days, updating the templates had to go through an IT team and all that stuff, updating the website, I mean. So paper, they know how to provide their services. All we did is we translated their paperwork and website work into an app that is a better means of information delivery to students in today's time. Students are, I mean, myself too, I don't check my personal emails as much. My friends are connecting with me on WhatsApp or Signal or other means of apps. And so app communication is happening. Except for my work emails, I don't really check any other emails as such. Everything is happening through apps. So we thought, you know, might as well build something that will help offices reach international students where they are.
Exactly. I mean, there's so many opportunities for you to sort of make things easier for your prospective users. And I think a lot of times, instead of asking, to your point, where can we meet our users or how can we meet our users where they are? You know, we look at it from our perspective as developers, but we should be looking at it from their perspective as users. So it's really smart. Before we jump into iCent, I want to talk just for very briefly about, you know, this experience that you had. You know, you came to Canada, you studied in Sheridan College, as you mentioned earlier, and you got your master's in project management, which it sounds like you probably already were a master in project management, because since you were a kid, you were making checklists and you're creating processes. But I want to ask you about this sort of whole parallel life you had as an entrepreneur, you know, I guess starting around 2008, 2009, you know, when you sort of were coming to Canada, where you were building your software, like you were building products, some of which I guess were successful, some of it which weren't. I think this is great. And I want to dig into this a little bit because, A, not only, you know, I guess this was your first, you know, foray into entrepreneurship. But then B, it sounds like you almost had your own lab where you tried different products. Some of them literally worked and became businesses that you exited. And others, I suppose, were a project that's experimented and didn't work. Can you talk a little bit about that? Like, first, I guess I'll ask you specifically, what are some, maybe one or two projects that or products that you built that didn't go anywhere, that, you know, you're like, okay, this isn't going to work. Can you share that? Because, and I want to say that I think it's important to talk about these because it's always easy to talk about the ones that succeed, but the ones that fail are just as important, especially as a lesson to others. So if you can share, if you remember, what were some of the ones where you were excited about, but then at the end were like, this is not going to happen. This isn't going anywhere.
Sure. The time around when I quit Zoom, I set up a company. The company is called Neil Tech, and we started experimenting different We meaning I had a small team of four people. I used to get projects, freelancing projects, try to see how things could work. Just wanted to build something right from scratch to start to finish so that I get that whole experience, holistic experience of understanding how softwares are built, what happens. I was very, very interested even during my engineering time into two programs, especially database and then software engineering. When I planned to study abroad, and I started to prepare in terms of examinations and things like that, I had this company that I had set up on the side to start experimenting things. And we built 9 different products. And iSent is the 9th one. 2 products we still have. iSent is one amongst them. The other one is I'm partners with one of the US-based companies. And that's we still keep that going. But all the other 7, one I sold to the founders that originally created that software and moved out of it in order to start iSent. The other 6 didn't really do very well. An example of what kind of softwares we built as a team of 4 people is a simple example is, we have used Constant Contact, MailChimp in today's time. We had an email software that would send bulk emails. So that kind of a software. All I wanted to do is we extended the use case in a way that we could automate certain things and not have to come back. Salesforce was kind of expensive to figure out. Getting a software, trying to look for prospective clients and have a CRM where basically you could house your prospects and start following up with them. Instead, I thought, the database itself, we'll build it into. It was built for our own use, our internal purpose to start with. Instead of paying money and getting something else, we wanted to experiment, build, use, and sell the same. Mm-hmm. So that was the goal. And we used it in-house for 2-3 years. And the CRM, where we call the newsletter tool or mass emailing tool that we built, that itself was our mini CRM, where we collected prospective client information, automated some process in terms of sending out reminders and updates about upgrades that happened to the software and things like that. And that we used for a little bit, and then we realized that there's more that's required as part of communication management, so that there are whole different products for that. So we didn't really see as much growth. Today, that software is one of the modules in iSent. We have 200 modules, and that particular piece is still plugged into iSent. And both are on similar technologies, except for the version is changed now. But that's one example, one good example. The other one was case management in terms of incidents, issues happening, like a support tracking, support system like Jira that we use today, a ticket management system, you can say. So our clients could reach out to us and say, here, there's an issue. Can you fix it? Here, there's a new enhancement, a change request, or those kind of things. So these are all different products that we thought will scale over a period of time, but we kept them as mini versions because I also got busy studying and working and doing other experiments. So turned out that those are modules that we use in today's time. But the original idea has not scaled as much as there's already Constant Contact for
that. So it's not like you started to build these products and tried to sell them and then it didn't work out and you shut them down. It looks like that, you didn't see a business case for it as its own company or own product to put on the market, but the underlying technology, it sort of still lives in what you're building today.
That's right. That's true. I mean, it wasn't really meant to scale, and it was built for our own foundation in a way that we would use it anyways in the future. That's part of the reason why we started investing into those softwares. And the most important thing that was on my mind at that point of time is I wanted to build a team and keep them busy. So I would come up with more ideas and software options to keep the team busy. The goal wasn't to really sell the software and make as much money, but the goal was to build a strong team. I still work with our 2 core team members are working with us since 2008. Yeah. So the goal was to build a team that can run for long. Today we are doing iSent, tomorrow we could be doing something else. But with the same team that has so much learning curve, we did 32 other projects, 8 different products before iSent. So it's the combination of the teamwork and how we could do things And that was the core focus back then.
So, and I have two questions for you before we kind of move on and to really talk about iSense. So the first one is, how are you funding all? It sounds almost like you had your own ideas and you're putting these people to work and, you know, building a team, building products. Did you have clients for all these product ideas? Were you self-funding it? Like, how were you economically making this work?
Sure. And this is exactly where I talked about 32 other projects. These were products that we built, small and big tools. But we used to do other projects on the side to basically make sure that there's consistent source of funding to be able to build products and to be able to try and experiment different things. So those projects were kind of, we built import-export shipment management software for one of the companies in Singapore, and they were trying to sell it further and use it as a SaaS tool back in 2008-09. And then we built a case management software for a detective agency in the US. So, so those kind of softwares that you know, even during my studies, I continued working for the company on the side, where I funded my education as well through the same.
Wow. And so how did you get these clients? I mean, especially going from shipment to, you know, to investigative firms, like how did people find out about you? How did you get that?
I mean, there are a lot of RFPs available online. We bid for the projects. We show our experience in terms of how these softwares, what work we have done, testimonials from existing clients. And it was certainly difficult because you had to, like, by the time you finished one project, you had to start looking for the next one or, you know, simultaneously manage multiple in some cases. But it was fun. I know that is part of the area where I think a lot of experience I gained in terms of trying to sell something that didn't really exist. We had to sell the concept at that point of time, understand the requirements. But around that time, I think 2010, 11, 12, many people wanted to build their own softwares, their own projects. Today, I think businesses that started around that time are well established. They have their own software in-house managing their own businesses. So we primarily approached those companies that were starting around that time or had established and were all manual work done, and we were trying to build a software for them. There was a company that we built library book management system, basically books management system. They used it in their office as a library, so employees could borrow books and things like that. So they knew who borrowed which book and how many days it is with them and have they returned it back on time or not. And nowadays we send push notifications, but back in the days we would send emails as reminders to admin and the student staff that basically, and I'm used to the word student, but yeah, staff that basically borrowed the books and things like that. So it was certainly fun in terms of being on the toes all the time, trying to figure out what next, what's coming up. But that was to keep things going. On the other hand, we knew we had to build a product to be able to survive and to have a recurring source of funds and to keep business going. Just that I wasn't sure what it would be. So we were trying to figure out through different experiments. And through those experiments, whatever we did, I think part of it also was, it didn't really touch me personally in terms of me trying to, I was trying to see if there is something that I would love doing for the rest of my life. So building an email system, building a case management system in terms of like a ticket management system, it's straightforward business. I want to do something that I share my personal values to, I truly believe in the long run, and that I would not really be bored of. And that turned out it was iSent. And that's the reason we kept investing into iSent all the initial years and didn't give up. Because working with public institutions versus private is a whole different ballgame.
I can't even imagine. I mean, for everything from RFP process to security to bureaucracy. That's such a great story, and I think a wonderful transition to my question to you, which would be: so, how did the idea for iSent come about? I mean, how did this become the product that you were building? And when did you say, okay, this is not just the product, this is going to be the company, this is going to be the thing that our team is going to focus on? When did that happen?
Yeah, during my studies in Canada at Sheridan, the very first day, I mean, long story short, the very first day I landed, there was a bit of a learning curve. And the very first day I landed, I started to think there is an opportunity here to build something, because I felt troubled the day I landed in terms of trying to go and try to find on-campus job and trying to figure out what else I could do, because I had a permit and I was allowed to work for 20 hours. I thought I'll work on my business and softwares 2-3 hours a day on the weekend and study for 6-7 hours a day. Work part-time for 3-4 hours a day at the school. So I went to school trying to figure out in case if I can find a job. They said, bring your like a SIN card, which is SSN in the US. In Canada is SIN, social insurance number. Mm. And I didn't know what it was. So I had to go back to the international office and figure out what it was. They said it's so-and-so. It's like your unique tax ID number and all that stuff. Went back and said, okay, I'll get it, but you know, I need a job offer letter to get that card. Otherwise, they wouldn't issue me a SIM card without a job offer. And when I went there, they asked for it. I came back, they said, no, without a SIM card, without a tax ID, we will not give you a job. So it was like a back and forth situation. And I was like, I was not the first person to be landing in Canada. And it was already 2010. People traveled to Canada as students since 80s, 90s. So like, there's something wrong here. So finally, I requested them and I said, can you give a conditional offer letter that says, if I get a SIM card, then you'll issue me a job? They said, okay. I took it back. Wow. They were hesitant to give that, but somehow they gave one and I took it back and I brought a paper copy and later on came the card. But I was like, you know, there's something off here. We should figure out what's going on. And probably I'm not the only student, because the school had 3,000 plus students back then, international. So since then, things began. Turned out that I graduated throughout my period of graduation. Again, project management checklist. I was studying project management anyways. So I created a checklist of all my pain points as a student. And I started to understand from other students what their challenges were as well. So my sister was in the US. I wanted to travel from Canada to US for Christmas holidays or during my reading week. And I had to go through another immigration process, go to U.S. consulate in Canada, get my U.S. visa, and then prepare for myself. So I filed that visa by myself, trying to navigate the immigration process. And all these learning experiences, I had a note of. So after my graduation, I was in a class of 35. I was the one who got selected for a telecom-based company to do my co-op. And the school called me back and said, here, sign a waiver. We'll use your resume as an example for other students. Come and talk to them once in a while. And it turned out that I used to go to the career center, talk to a few students. I already had the experience. I was building softwares. I was able to manage it okay. So these students that came were freshers, like, you know, for the first time after graduation, first experience outside trying. So I liked that experience. Mentoring, trying to figure out, help others, and it was international students. They were full of energy, all kids. I was a kid myself too, so it was a fun experience. I thought I want to stay associated in this space with education sector, with particularly international immigration, and I started building something seen behind. Which I wrote to the school in 2013, 2 years after my graduation, and said, here's something that I've built for myself. I've used it myself, but I had helped around 69 students by that time in those 2 years of graduation. And turned out that, you know, it's very common. I from India, my family, somebody's friend, somebody's brother, sister, son that wanted to come to Canada. I was connected with to say that here is somebody that we know. Talk to him. He might give you some advice. And before I went, I had to talk to my friend, my dad's friend's son as well, to understand how things work, because my parents would be comfortable only that way. So I turned out that these students that I was trying to help, they had a lot of legal questions, and I was not an authority to answer those questions. And I did not want to take the risk and liability of delivering information that I was not fully aware of, because immigration laws change every now and then. There are certain other legal aspects in terms of school, insurance, et cetera, et cetera. So I thought, you know, this tool belongs to the school and not to me. So it has to be in the hands of authorities that are responsible to deliver this information to students. So I wrote to the school, asked them in case if they wanted something that I had built, and not necessarily for commercial reasons, just something that I wanted to do as a thank you to the school as well. It took 2 years for them to say yes, that they want to use it. They used it for a year and then finally said, we want you to support this tool and we'll pay you XYZ. And they helped us launch the tool, used it for 3,500 students. The first day of launch, or the first week of launch rather, they had 3 orientation events in different cities or different parts of the world. We had 1,100 downloads of the 2,000 students that were coming. So they knew right away that it was going to be used. And that's when I decided, this is going to be my full-time business. Wow. So slowly we tweaked that tool from being an independent nuclear or binary tool to basically start focusing on a SaaS-based product that we could scale. And we did not really market it, advertise it as much. We just did it with one school, one full year, completed 3 terms, built everything that they wanted as part of their use cases, and then started selling it to other schools.
You know, it's crazy to think about how long all of this took, because you graduated in what, 2010, you said?
11.
Okay. And then you had two years later, you just pitched them the idea.
Yes.
Right. Yes, so 2013. And then, you know, it took them 2 years to even say, yes, we'll use it. So yeah, really, right. By 2015 is when they're just starting to use it. And, right. You know, and to your point, I guess it doesn't just, and that's just using it. That's not saying, that's saying we'll try it. That's not saying, hey, right. We're going to, you know, we're going to go buy it. Here's money, et cetera. So, yeah, I mean, that's a long time for you to just continue to support this and to be, you know, confident about what you want to do and to be, I guess, passionate and excited about it. How did you navigate that, I guess, as somebody who is sort of an entrepreneur and a founder, and not give up and say, you know what, forget it. This is taking too long, too much red tape. You know, let me just move on and do something else that's going to be more lucrative. Because I know you were working on the side to support yourself, I guess, right? But
That's right.
You know, there's still emotion that has to go into this. You still have to keep pushing. You have your team. They have to stay motivated. How did you do all that?
You know, I believed in this concept, and I thought it would be useful for sure, because I used it myself and few other people that I tried to help with, with a disclaimer that I was not an authority to provide them that information, but they would have to do their own due diligence. So I was always busy. I've been extremely busy right since beginning. So it was not the case that it was like a do or die situation, that if they said no, like it was end of the world. I knew that this was the 9th product. I mean, we were always trying and experimenting something. But I was personally very interested in this. So I knew, working with public sector, that those 2 years of wait, I realized I have to be persistent. Otherwise, I'm not going to have a buy-in here. And after my graduation, the first 2 years that I was still working and trying to figure out, I was still associated with the school, trying to understand how the school system works, going back to school campus, trying to figure out and support other students with their questions, especially when it comes to resume and things like that. So I knew how the school system works, and decisions would not be taken right away. But I knew that they're up to something very professional, because like unlike a private sector, like our decisions for the most part, in today's time, we take enough time to build, to make decisions ahead of time and plan and implement, because we work with public sector. But these schools, like their budget for next year is done like in advance. They know what they're going to deliver in terms of programs. They know what students they're targeting, which country. Like they have a plan, and they operate in a very project-oriented, they have a very project-oriented approach. And I liked that. I loved that process. And I was like, if I have to be in that space and experience that, then I have to be patient to get there first. Mm-hmm. So I had to build that patience in me and be persistent with them. And so our sales cycle is usually anywhere between 1 year to 4 years.
Wow. That's, You know, it's almost a breath of fresh air in today's world of maybe not as much anymore, but this idea of like start a company, you raise $50 million and you sell it for $500 million in 3 years. You know, there was this, I feel like there was this time when everyone assumed that you build a software company, you can exit it in under 5 years and, you know, be this like really successful person. But most businesses are not like that. Most businesses take time, especially if you're selling to organizations, if you're selling to public, you know, universities, things like nonprofits, et cetera. So I think the key word for me there is you're patient and you had to build the patience inside of you. And maybe if you didn't know much about the higher ed process, it would have been harder for you to build the patience, but you were there. You were there in Spain. You were there as a student in Canada. And I feel like, you know, you're not taking it personally, the fact that they're taking a long time. You just understand that that's the way that
that's part of the process.
Yeah.
That's right.
That's really cool. Yeah. So, you know, now I think it's a really great time for me to ask, what is iSent and what does it do?
Sure. The department that supports international students in many schools, it's called International Center. So iSent is an abbreviation for International Center. International is I, Center is sent, so iSent. The product is basically a international student support CRM that helps them with pre-departure information, post-arrival or arrival information, landing information, acclimatization, academic success, graduation, career prospects. So it's the 360-degree support that schools provide to international students with special care because they are students coming from a foreign country. The schools are not just providing education, but they're providing a cultural experience in the country that they're studying. So they have pretty good policies in place to basically take care of international students with extra care and extra effort that's required, because these international students might be homesick, they might be traveling first time. There's hundreds of other bells and whistles attached to a student studying abroad. So our product basically supports the international office with providing the kind of information that students want, the handholding and the supports that's required during the academic life cycle. So in a nutshell, iSent is a digital version of Student Handbook.
Are they able to, are students who use it able to apply for anything through the app or at least like put together their student visa application? I guess my question is, can they take action through the app? Is it just information and connection to the school? Is it a combination of both?
No, it's a combination of three things. Information delivery from international office perspective. In some cases, it's called student service office. So information delivery, communication management, two ways, whether it is chat, push, email communication, service desk, help desk, or it is exchange of documents, issuing documents, collecting documents, passport, visa, issuing documents like travel support letter and things like that. And third is student engagement, to basically make sure that students are engaged in cultural activities, global competency activities, career prospects, career workshops, and collaborative events and activities. So to keep the experience going, to build great alumni graduating from these schools. So it's the entire student lifecycle journey that's covered on the platform. And we didn't call it CRM off the bat when we got started. We called it the pre-arrival orientation tool. And as we grew with additional modules, we have, in fact, we just recently started calling it the student support CRM. Until then, we just called it as an international office software suite or a mobility suite that basically helps schools with bringing students on board, supporting them. If these students were interested in traveling abroad, for a semester work or study program, then their visa process, their document collection, their insurance, and all of that is on the software. So it works both ways, supporting students coming inbound and supporting those students that are traveling abroad, whether it is domestic Canadian students or international.
So I read recently that actually, you know, I'm in the US, so that, you know, the past couple of years, especially during the prior administration here, in the U.S., there was actually a decline in foreign students, in part because the H-1B visa was really, taking a hit from a policy standpoint. And obviously, a lot of international students come to the U.S. to hopefully eventually get the H-1B visa. On the flip side, during the pandemic, if I remember this correctly, the Canadian government was very flexible of starting to study abroad and still having that count towards your postgraduate work permit, which is right. Our version of OPT. The ability to work and things like that. Did you see coincides the last few years with your growth? I mean, did you see any increased interest during this period of COVID, or was COVID sort of a challenge for the business because travel was down and borders were closed?
Sure. I think international educated people who want to study abroad will study no matter what. I mean, I'm from the same category because I dreamt of studying abroad right since my school days, and I didn't want to give up on that. I just delayed because of U.S. recession in 2008 or global recession. I just delayed it for 2 years, but I still did what I wanted to do in terms of study abroad. So two phases of growth, exactly the way you put it, it was right. The previous U.S. administration declined in number of international students because of policy changes. Canada saw a lot of growth in terms of international students. That was a plus for us because the Canadian market in terms of international students grew quite big in 2018-19. That was around the time that I also started to understand how a little more deeper in terms of how exactly international office operations happen, recruitment happens, support happens. So that was a real good growth period. Then came the COVID, and turned out that I was worried in 2020. I knew that supports are still required because we are student support software. Students that were already on campus needed that support, in country needed the support. And we have clients, 90% of our clients are in Canada, but we have clients in US, New Zealand, and Europe as well. So we knew that software would, like our services would still be required, but I started to think about future growth. But then there's a lot of immigration policies that got changed. You're right, Canadian government or the Canadian Immigration Department, which is also one of our clients, talked about allowing students to study from home, like online, and then they would count those days that they would be studying online from home towards their postgraduate work permit and immigration at a later stage. So that was, Canada was really a plus for students to pick and choose Canada as a destination of study. And that basically helped us keep our business going and make sure that we support these students. And as part of what we do is, I do realize that providing software as a service alone in this space was not enough, because these schools that we work with are more like government offices. They start on time, close on time. Weekends is a holiday unless and until it's crisis and real emergency. So I knew there's more support service that we could build for off office hours and weekends. So we have our own contact center team that we are an outsourced level one support office for many international schools, international offices, that we take, we support these students, whether like worldwide 200 plus countries through our support center, off office hours and during the weekends. In fact, we do it 24/7. And that support kicked off really well during COVID times because they needed remote support to provide support services to these students that were studying from 200 plus countries. And we scaled our team to 18 during COVID, and we supported 160,000 students, tracked every single student's travel intention, intended arrival date, quarantine plan, the quarantine process, arrival check-in to say that they have safely landed, and 14 days of check-in to basically make sure that they complete and let the school know that they are safe and everything is okay. So we managed this program and we were approved by the public health. The presidents had to give a readiness plan in order for the immigration department to approve arrival supports for international students. So travel support issuance and all of that was done through the software. So that basically gave a double boost to for the business from, you know, in terms of business growth.
Did you have to work with the universities to get, you know, the support information from them? Because clearly you're sort of an outsourced help center for international students who, instead of calling the university, are now calling your team. Did you have to work with the different schools that, you know, are your clients to say, okay, here's our policy? So when a student calls the outsourced center, where are you from? You're in Sheridan College. Great. What's your question? And then they give the answer that Sheridan, that's specific to Sheridan College.
That's right. So different staff members on the team are trained for different schools. We use the app in-house ourselves too, to click a button and understand what's the, you know how about that particular college, query a chatbot and ask a question, and the chatbot would answer. So we have self-serve tools put in front of students in the form of chatbot. If they have questions, they can connect with the live chat agent. They can do a calling, in-app audio calling, video calling. There are various means or tiers of support that are set up, and they can even book an appointment to talk to somebody, either on our end or the school end. So there's set of, this is why I called it level one support. We know what we can handle. Those most frequently asked questions is what we handle. Those that have a standard answers for. A very simple example is, I forgot my school password or student information system password. How do I reset? It's a standard answer. We don't need a school to answer. We don't need a human resource to answer. The bot can answer this question. Here's a link to reset your password. These are the instructions. If you still have issues, connect with us. So believe it or not, this is basically, most of the questions are those straightforward questions that students have. They're not reading it on the website. They're not reading it in their instructions. They're not reading it somewhere. They're not reading it on the app. It's on the app. So they connect and ask this question, and they want answers right away. Schools are not usually available to answer these questions right away, because the student might be in India, China. During their day, they're writing an email, which is night time in Canada, for example, and the school is obviously not going to respond back. So we are primarily focused on automating these processes that are straightforward, and there's a lot of learning curve and experience. We support over 150 different schools in today's time globally, and that is combined over 800 campuses.
Wow, that's incredible. You must have a lot of data now on different student activity and trends and things like that. So I feel like at some point, at some level of growth, you can now start feeding information back to the industry and saying, hey, you guys are all disjointed, so you don't see these patterns. We actually see these patterns, whatever that might be, asking certain types of questions or where people are coming from, what they're studying, I don't know, things like that. I'm assuming there must be some interesting insights there.
There's already, we do work with the high school, International High Schools Association, Language Schools Association, colleges and universities. We are not working with ASIAT, the association, but we work at all levels of education to basically to support their initiatives. They use our platform as well for various reasons. They're educators, so they're natural mentors, I would say. So I've been lucky to have a lot of mentors in the space that has helped us. Those have helped us build the platform, give us the right piece of advice. So there's been a lot of good stuff. The very first client, his name is Andrew Ness. He bought the concept, but it took him a lot of time to get things done, seen behind. But a lot of great clients that have helped a lot. Umesh himself has been a great mentor and support. So just been lucky to be in the right place at the right time, and just a little bit of patience. I think it has worked out.
That's fantastic advice. So this has been really awesome. I like to end these conversations with kind of maybe a more fun or different type of question. I know you've lived, I guess you grew up in India, you lived there, you lived in Spain, you took some trips to the UK, you've obviously now lived in Canada, and you've traveled to the US for work as well, right?
That's right. Yeah, I joined Zoom again as a consultant in between for some time, looking after their Canadian clients, a few implementations while I was doing Iceland. They wanted local presence in Canada, so I picked that contract up and supported them a little bit there.
And also great, as you're building a business, you know, if you don't have a lot of outside capital or any outside capital, did you guys raise any money or were you bootstrapped from the beginning?
Completely bootstrapped. And, you know, there's, I think, you know, in order to build the tool, right ideas and patience and implementation processes are required. Money is only a byproduct if you want to skip timelines.
Right.
And we have not really figured out that part yet. If we want to raise funds and stuff like that, we are self-sufficient right now, and we are sailing okay. And we see a path for ourselves for the next 5 years in terms of what we want to achieve and do. We like the bootstrap model.
That's great. And you maintain control. You maintain, you know, you are the last decision maker. Once you get outside capital, you know, you sort of have a boss now in a way.
True. But in today's time, the way I look at it is our clients are our boss. Sure. They tell us what to do. We just figure out whether it's the right fit for our product. If yes, we accept, build it in. If not, we politely decline and focus on what we are very focused on what how the product should be built, because we see a life for the product. It might be the case that a school may have budget at one point, might differ and delay for a little bit, but the product has to sustain and survive. So we focus on the product quite a lot and focus on what clients want to use as part of the product.
That's awesome. That's a great point too. And I think, again, a wonderful example of a business that is bootstrapped, is patient, and is sustainable, I think, and continues to do great work. And I love sharing these stories because, in my view, it's a great counterbalance to all of the flash that you see on the news with companies raising a ton of money and moving really quickly. And that works in some contexts, but I think many tech founders, especially ones that are trying to build their first tech company, I was guilty of this. You know, the idea is, okay, let's build a very MVP. Let's go out and raise, you know, a ton of capital. That playbook is very popular. And I think people try to superimpose that playbook in industries and contexts where it's not always the best way to go. And they don't see alternatives where you can do it yourself, you can build it slowly, you can take separate projects on the side to, you know, sustain yourself. So, you know, thank you for sharing what you've done, and you know, congratulations on what you've done, because I think it's a traditional business model where you build something of value, you find something that someone that will pay for it, and you take your time to get to a place of you know, success, you know, instead of being impatient and trying to get it right away. So as we close out here, I guess I'm curious, and maybe this isn't a question that is really difficult, that is very easy to answer, but I still am curious, because you've traveled all over the world. Do you have a favorite city that you've been to? And if you have, you know, is there a memory from that city that really sticks out from a travel perspective?
I love Toronto. That's why I'm there. I mean, I've traveled to, I mean, education conferences happen worldwide, international education conferences. I've probably traveled to 28 different countries so far. A lot of learning curve. I'm a foodie. I love different food from different countries and learning different cultures. I enjoy that experience. But Toronto is truly multicultural. I'm not selling Toronto, but I really love being here in Toronto, and it's a place where I can find, it's truly multicultural, a lot of food options, great city, except for the snow and winter times, you know, everything else is great about the city. Apart from that, you know, I love Florida, US, you know, if I have to vacation, I would like to go there and spend some time. Everywhere else, I would just like to spend a little time and come back. In the near future, I have plans to move for a couple months to New Zealand, because we have a client there. We are trying to grow our business there. And I might be off Canada for a little bit, live in New Zealand, set up a few things there, and then come back.
Well, I'm going to have to ask you this question after you go to New Zealand, because I have a suspicion that you're going to be wowed by the beauty and you're going to say, all right, I'm not coming back.
Yeah, it is true. You know, I feel some similarities between Western Canada, where it's all great landscape, Switzerland and New Zealand. They're kind of feels pretty much the same, the scenic beauty and all that. But yeah, I mean, Toronto is home, so I would certainly come back home. But New Zealand is going to be fun. So if you're around, we can have fun there.
I'd love to. I've never been to New Zealand, and I would love to go. And I think that the Canadian, the Ontario Tourism District, you should get a paycheck from them, or a check from them in the mail, because I'm sold. I was in Toronto a couple of weeks ago. And I love it. I love Toronto. So that's great. Well, Ganesh, thank you so much. This was an awesome episode and a really great conversation. Thank you for sharing everything and about your background and, of course, your growth. And again, going into detail about building a business within the context of bootstrapping and being patient and working with, you know, institutions and clients that are not your traditional clients, but are definitely more challenging. I think this is really valuable, and I hope that listeners get some value out of it. I know I learned a lot, so I appreciate it. And again, thank you so much for joining.
Thank you for your time. Thank you for all the great questions. And I got an opportunity to relive some of the moments building the company, growing up, and all of that. So thank you. It's been great.
Likewise. Thanks, man.